This morning in this part of the show, we'll be talking a little bit about the history of American air power. And usually when people talk about that subject, they concentrate on World War II. However, it was an earlier war, World War I, that first inspired the vision of American dominance through a massive air force. This morning, we'll be exploring some of this territory with Linda Robertson. She is the author of a book titled The Dream of Civilized Warfare. The subtitle is World War I Flying Aces and the American Imagination. The book is published by the University of Minnesota Press. And she uses the book to explore the ways in which air combat came to represent American ingenuity. And also she looks at how the carefully crafted image of the flying ace helped to offer to Americans a vision of civilized warfare. We put that in quotes, something that presented a very stark contrast to the muddy and brutal world of the trenches in World War I. As we talk, questions are certainly welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. At any point here, people have questions, they can call. The only thing we ask of callers is that they're brief so that we can keep the program moving, get in as many people as possible. But certainly anyone who is listening is welcome to call. Let me just tell you a little bit more about our guest, Linda Robertson. She is professor of writing and rhetoric at Hobart and William Smith Colleges, located in Geneva, New York. And she is a scholar of the media, and she's particularly interested in war propaganda and its historical influence on the American imagination. That's what leads her to think about air power in World War I. That's one of the subjects that she's interested in. Any point here, if people have questions and comments, you can certainly give us a call. Well, Professor Robertson, hello.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me to share your program with you today.
Well, we appreciate it. It is, I guess, when I look at you and your background, you're certainly not a military historian, but then knowing your interest in the subject of media and war propaganda, I guess then it's not exactly surprising that something like this would catch your interest.
Well, I would like to just say a word or two about that. I was teaching a course basically on the Cold War propaganda and the use of nuclear power in armaments, the nuclear standoff, with three other colleagues here at Hobart and William Smith College when the first Persian Gulf War started. And two things struck me. One, you know, the bombing was scheduled to be shown on primetime television on the East Coast. So the bombing attack started at 7 o'clock our time here. And the next day they described Americans as euphoric about this bombing. And I thought, when did it get to be okay for Americans to bomb cities? I mean, this seemed such a reversal of American ethos. And the second was that when I went in to talk to my students, all of the propaganda messages which were being recycled, they were accepting absolutely, and I had been teaching them about them. For example, we shouldn't talk about this war because it might demoralize the troops on the front, in Kuwait and Saudi Arabia. So that it was just impressive to me how this information campaign with regard to how people should think about this war was so impressive, even on young people who were being taught to be wary of it. And it was from that I then went on to find out what are the roots of American thinking about air wars as being very virtuous, very clean, not carrying any of the stigma, for instance, of the ground war in Vietnam. And that's why I've come to the conclusion that really we've been looking at our history not going back far enough, that the idea that this was the virtuous way for Americans to fight war really begins in World War I.
And that was a deliberate attempt to provide to Americans some sort of cleaner, more elegant, more honorable alternative, another way of thinking about war that was very different than the reality of the trench warfare of the time, which was not only indeed muddy and brutal and bloody, but really when you look at it from a military point of view, indecisive.
Yes, the sense that America had entered the stalemated war, also a European kind of way of fighting, and that we were going to absolutely rescue Europe from the skies. This was very important to the way that the war was characterized to Americans, who, after all, had not wanted to get into this war. Wilson had just been reelected on the platform, he kept us out of war. When the Lusitania was sunk, Wilson had said, sometimes men have to be too proud to fight. And here we were not only in a war, but we were going to the Selective Service for really the first time in American history. There had been conscription in the North during the Civil War, which had caused riots. This was going to be a universal conscription, and not for a war fought on American soil, but for a war fought in Europe. There was tremendous resistance to this. So for a variety of reasons, fighting war from the air just seemed like the American way to fight war. And one of the reasons was we didn't have an Air Force, so we were completely uninformed on the facts. It just could be fabricated in the imagination as a tremendous way for America to show its ingenuity. We didn't have a single combat plane or a single combat-ready pilot when we entered the war.
At that point, when the United States entered the war and the determination was made to build an Air Force, mm-hmm. as you say, we didn't have one, and no one really knew exactly how to do it, but apparently in Washington they decided, well, we'd better have some money. We'd better put some money into this. And very hurriedly, there was a bill passed by Congress, apparently with very little discussion, a bill that would put money into developing the Air Force. And I guess it's also interesting to look at how quickly it was passed. Very little debate. Anybody who criticized it was criticized himself. And then all that long after, there was criticism of the bill then and of the way that the money was spent or how poorly thought out the whole enterprise was.
Yeah, it does start to feel kind of American and contemporary when you look at it, because any congressman who said, yeah, but how's this money going to be spent and what are the conditions for letting these contracts? And this really was the beginning of the military-industrial complex. Because the automotive workers or automotive magnates were absolutely determined that those contracts would come to automotive manufacturers. They completely shut out the aircraft building industry from participating in these contracts at all. So there was no inquiry really into how's this money going to be spent? Do they know what they're doing? And as a result, this promised aerial armada, which was supposed to be larger than all of the combined forces of the combatants in Western Europe, never materialized. And in fact, we bought our combat planes from France. So there was inquiries then in Congress and in the Justice Department into what had gone wrong, what kind of corruption was involved, that is, in not producing this incredible force. Well, you just couldn't in that. We knew nothing about air combat. Nothing about its the specialized forms that had been developed in Europe during the war. And a combination of ignorance, greed, and optimism led to about $1 billion being either misappropriated or used to buy planes that were already built in Europe.
You make the argument that, I don't know if I'm overstating this, but seem to be making the argument that we can find some of the roots of this thing that has been called the military-industrial complex mm-hmm. in this very time, and in fact, this very effort to build this sector of the American military.
Yeah, I absolutely think that this is where you see the training ground for it. The effort on the part of the automotive industry to become connected with the government was very clearly done. These were men who were called a dollar-a-year men. It was illegal for people in the private sector to actually be involved in issues connected with contracts, government expenditures. So they were hired by the government at a dollar a year, and a number of them were actually given commissions. But they were very much connected with the automotive industry. They had been the magnates who had built the automotive industry. Once they were appointed to the production board for the aircraft industry, they literally denied contracts to any of the people who had actually been working on developing the aircraft. Their idea was that they would simply standardize all of the engines for the planes the way that they had standardized engines for cars. And you can't do that with airplanes. So they produced planes that either wouldn't fly or were deadly to those who flew them. Of course, by the end of the war, we did have a very good-sized actual Air Force in terms of bombers, B-52 Because that's the other part of this story that I think is so important. The military planners, both in Europe and in the United States, very quickly came to feel that bombing behind the lines, morale bombing of civilian sites, as well as bombing military production sites, was the way to win the war. But they couldn't really let this be known in the United States because of the aversion to what the Germans were doing with their Zeppelins bombing cities, and also with their Gotha bombers bombing cities in England, that this was an outrage against the moral imagination, and it just proved that they were Huns, that they were uncivilized, that they were barbarians. And yet, this is exactly what we were preparing to do. There were plans to bomb Berlin if the Kaiser had not accepted the terms for the armistice. We would have bombed Berlin. So there were really two things going on. One was a kind of misappropriation of American talent and ingenuity with regard to building airplanes. But the second was keeping it a rather dark secret, the kind of planes that we were looking towards as the way to win the war from the air.
Well, I think that's interesting, given the kind of thing that we're talking about here, the glorification of the image of the ace.
Mm-hmm.
That's a completely different sort of thing than a strategic aerial bombing.
Exactly.
A totally different thing.
Yeah, and the reality is that the image of what an air war would be like had been the product of propaganda aimed at the United States, particularly by France and Great Britain. It was in the interest of France and Great Britain to bring the United States into the war. And when it became obvious that the ground war really wasn't going to allow for the production of heroes, the production of the glory of war, it was something that really you didn't want to have to display too much. They began developing their flyers as tremendous heroes, first the French and then more reluctantly the English. But news about air-to-air combat, about the heroics of individual pilots from Germany, France, and Great Britain really flooded the United States, so that the image Americans had in their minds was of the phrase we still use, the Knights of the Air. Any book of a popular nature that you pick up about World War I air war, it's all about the Knights of the Air, these chivalric heroes who ride off to individual air-to-air combat. Absolutely the alternative vision to warfare from what was being produced on the ground, where individuality didn't matter, where death had nothing to do with character. So a very different and yet older way of characterizing war is transferred to the air war, and I think it's what most Americans thought we were going to be doing with this armada, sending our chivalric youth off to prevail in the air in single-handed combat. It simply was not really what was planned.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Linda Robertson. She's professor of writing and rhetoric at Hobart and William Smith College, and that's in Geneva, New York. She's the founder and director of the Media and Society program there. She is also, interestingly enough, the co-host of a weekly radio talk show, Plato's Cave, which is produced on campus through the college's radio station WEOS, and it is fed to satellite for national distribution and is heard on some several hundred radio stations around the country. If you're interested in the subject here we're talking about, The Dream of Civilized Warfare is the book, looking at World War I flying aces and the American imagination, and it is published by the University of Minnesota Press. We do have a caller here and would certainly welcome others. Questions are welcome, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that is good anywhere you can hear us, 800-222-9455. The caller is in Savoy, line number one.
Oh, hi, how you doing? Yeah.
Yes.
My grandfather was a World War I veteran in the Army, and he went to France, and he never did reach the real heavy fighting, but, you know, it's just as you described. It was the letter. I've read the letters that he wrote home, and I'll tell you what, it was something else, and it was very brutal on the ground. And then as a small child growing up, I was very interested in airplanes. And for a Christmas present, I got a copy of Rickenbacker's autobiography, and it was actually signed by him. And that book is very revealing about what actually went on. Did you happen to read Rickenbacker's autobiography?
Rickenbacker's autobiography is an extremely important book. It was wonderful that he signed it for you, or that you have a signed copy.
Yes.
Couple of things about Rickenbacker. He was our top ace, and his squadron, the Hat and the Ring Squadron, was the first one to fight or to fly over enemy lines.
Yes.
It was an American squadron.
Yeah.
And it was also the squadron with the highest score in terms of defeating the enemy. And they almost didn't let Rickenbacker in.
Yeah, he was nearly shut out of that
and
washed out, yeah.
He was too old.
Right.
He didn't have a college education. They thought only college-educated men were astute enough to learn how to do this.
Yeah.
And also that as someone who had driven race cars, that he knew too much about motors and mechanics, and that as soon as he found out how these planes were actually built, he wouldn't get into one.
Right. He was very, he was one of the first pilots, you know, he was one of the first people to really think that it's not so much the airplane, it's the pilot that's the real asset here. And,
he
tried to emphasize that.
Well, he had learned this from the books he had read before going into the Air Force. He himself had read books written in Great Britain. And produced for American consumption about the glories of the British Air War. And the emphasis in those books was on the pilot, not the machine.
Right, yeah.
And one of the reasons was that the machines built by the British were inferior to the Germans.
Yeah, they had real problems.
Yeah.
The Germans had really good aircraft, and they were well thought out, and they didn't really catch up until very late in the war.
Yes, and, So
for
public consumption, they emphasized the individuality of the pilot. Also, part of the way that the Allies did talk about the difference between Germans and Americans was that, or Germans and the Allies, was that Germans were trained by the Prussians to be automatons, to not think for themselves, that therefore this was a defense of individualism or freedom and individuality against this authoritarian regime. So Rickenbacker read those books. He was very impressed by them. He was very impressed to meet some of the pilots who had written those books. The real important thing, I think, that Rickenbacker did was create this image of what the character of the American pilot should be.
Yeah.
That the American pilot should be a team player, that it should be as much about what the squadron could achieve together as it was about what the individual could achieve, although the individual then became somebody who was also very much a celebrity.
Yeah, I was really impressed with that book. And, you know, in that book, you know, it goes on, you know, he was an extraordinary man.
Mm-hmm.
But that the accounts of when he was flying during World War I are just fascinating.
Yeah, they are.
And then that book, also a great thing to read because of his racing days. And then, you know, the founding of Eastern Airlines, and he was actually lost at sea for many days. He nearly died at sea in a plane. You know, they were lost at sea
After
the war.
Yeah.
And it's one of the most fascinating books I've ever read.
Well, I can tell you some background to that. The person who actually wrote the words for that book is a man named Driggs.
Yeah.
And he probably did more to shape the American understanding of air combat in World War I than any other American writer. And he went on to found Eastern Airlines along with Rickenbacker.
Right,
so the two of them were very, very close.
Yeah.
And that's why I say that Rickenbacker's book, as written by Driggs, is extremely important in shaping the way Americans conceptualize the American warrior in the sky.
Yeah, it's one of my prized possessions.
It should be. It's a wonderful book.
And it's actually signed by Rickenbacker. Hey, I'll let you go.
Oh, well, thank you.
It was wonderful to hear from you.
Goodbye.
Other folks who are listening, if you have questions or comments, certainly you're welcome to call 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. One of the things that you talked about at the beginning as being significant changes in the way Americans prepared to go to war, there are a couple of things. One you touched on and one that you haven't yet, I wanted to ask you about.
Yeah.
Well, one thing that you mentioned was the move toward selective service and conscription rather than a volunteer force. The other thing that kind of goes with that is also a move away from volunteer officers to a kind of a professional officer corps that we have come to know. And what's interesting is that it seemed that with the ACE, with the flyer, it was a way to hold on to that thing that the military at the time was moving away from.
Yeah, I think that, I'm glad you mentioned that, because I do think it's very important. It is still the case that if you're going to be a pilot, you volunteer for it. And you are, once breveted, you are an officer. And it's really important to remember that, especially in contrast to the tremendous change in the military that World War I constituted. The idea that there would be universal conscription was just so adverse to the way America had thought of itself. This was something very European, that everybody should be required to be in the service, certainly very Prussian. In France, conscription was called the blood tax, that by serving in the service, more men were enfranchised, actually. They gained their status as citizens. Absolutely contrary to the American way of thinking, that we don't derive our rights from the government. The government derives its power from individual citizens. So you had that, and you also had the military deciding it really wasn't going to go for volunteer officers anymore, which is the way that things had been done. And I do agree with some commentators who say that the reason for that was that Teddy Roosevelt volunteered to organize the 1st Regiment and make them volunteers and take them overseas to fight. And that this is Woodrow Wilson's arch political rival, and he just would have none of this. I'm not sure it's the whole reason that we went for selective service instead of voluntary forces, but I really have to think that the historians who have concluded it was one of the reasons, that if Roosevelt had been able to organize volunteers to send overseas to fight this war, how would they have legitimized the draft? What would they have used as their argument? So the argument that Wilson made is that war is now a very scientific thing. It's not a matter of glory. It's not a matter of heroics. It's very scientific. It's very requires a great deal of efficiency, and that we just have to agree that every American male will want to volunteer, but that we need the selective service to organize that manpower. That was the excuse that he used for conscription. Well, you know, if you're a nation that has valued the officer and the volunteer, it gets transferred almost immediately to the Air Force. That's where that part of the imagined glory of war goes. And we've had it ever since. I mean, I don't think anybody would disagree that whenever we see a plane taking off from a carrier or a stealth bomber taking off into the night sky, everybody feels that sense of combination of glory and glamour associated with a pilot in his plane.
We have someone else here to talk with North Belgium. That's over by Danville, not the country. Line number 4 here, our toll-free line. Hello.
Yes, hello. Yeah, I'm curious as to... either I didn't know or I had forgotten. I have forgotten. What did Billy Mitchell do during the war? Because I used to have the book, the Court Martial of Billy Mitchell.
Yeah.
And I had given this book to my dad, and he gave it to somebody else. And I wish he hadn't, but... if you want to comment on Billy Mitchell, I'll just hang up and listen.
Sure.
Thank you very much.
It's a good question, because he was the guy who we were talking about, the advent of the idea of strategic bombing. That was his thing.
Oh, absolutely. It's such a great question, because if any American was responsible for shaping the direction of American air power, it was Billy Mitchell during World War I. Mitchell was sent to Europe almost immediately after we entered the war. He was the only member of what was then the United States Signal Corps, which is where the Air Service was located, until it was declared a separate branch. He was the only one who actually could fly. There were very few officers, and very few actually had their wings. So he was sent over to Europe to find out really what kind of Air Force we needed. And while he was there, he met with the French, and who had already decided that what they needed was a separate bomber corps. And he met especially with Hugh Trenchard in England, who was absolutely the iron-fisted, iron-willed leader of the Royal Air Force, who felt that it was bombers that were absolutely needed to overcome the German defensive posture on the ground. And they persuaded Billy Mitchell that the future of air warfare was in bombers, that the future of warfare itself was to prevail from the air, so that what set America off on developing an air force was a cable that came from the French government called the Ribault cable. And this cable asked Americans to develop an air force larger than the combined air forces of Germany, France, and Great Britain. This was absolutely a breathtaking request. This is a request that ultimately Congress approved. Again, in total ignorance of what any of this was about, Billy Mitchell helped to compose that cable, although I'm not sure very many people in the United States at the time knew it. And what he was really advocating was developing, in addition to planes that would be spotter planes for artillery, which is what the initial plans called for. That was an allocation of about $54 million to develop spotter planes. In addition to that, developing an air force capable of long-range bombing, along with the pursuit planes needed to support those bombers. It was that request that was the foundation for the United States Air Force as we know it today, and it was Billy Mitchell who was behind it. And in addition, he was also decorated by the French because he was a combat pilot over the lines. He was one of the first to fly after we declared war. There was, of course, Americans flying the Lafayette Escadrille and in the Royal Air Force before the war. But he was one of the first to fly after we got into the war. He was decorated. He was a very fine combat pilot and extremely astute. He saw the French forces absolutely wiped out at Verdun, and he knew that the ground war could not be won. It would just be a way of bleeding both all countries dry, and felt the only way to win the war was to carry it behind the lines. And he spoke of democratizing warfare, by which he meant instead of having the flower of American male youth killed, to carry it straight to the home front, to bomb the civilians and bomb the factories so that they would quickly sue for a peace. As I say, the dimensions of American air warfare really were laid out in World War I. Billy Mitchell was extremely important to that. He, of course, remained extremely important until his court-martial. And my feeling about his court-martial was Billy Mitchell may have disobeyed orders, but he was absolutely right that the advent of the airplane absolutely changed the role of the Navy.
When people think about World War I, I'm sure the images that will come to mind are images of trench warfare. Mm-hmm. And interestingly enough, that gives you a really incomplete picture of the war and how it was fought. Last year, for example, I had the opportunity to talk with Robert Massey, who has written a couple of books now about naval power in that era. Particularly, mm-hmm. his most recent is about big naval battles of World War I. And he makes the argument that what happened on the sea was much more important to the outcome of the war than what happened on land. Having said all that, when you look at the strategic significance of air power and the air war in World War I, was it indeed important? Did it influence the outcome of the war one way or another?
Most of the analysts of the air war will say it had almost no influence on the outcome whatsoever, and that the most important use of the airplane was not in combat, but in taking pictures of the enemy lines, which is not an heroic combat in the sky. It is just a very difficult kind of flying to do because you have to fly an airplane in a straight line while taking pictures. Usually it was two people in the plane doing this. They did not receive any of the recognition that these combat pilots received because the combat pilots were serving primarily a propaganda purpose. And strategic bombing just didn't evolve to the level that it was going to evolve to in World War II. I do want to say that what was going on under the sea with submarine warfare and also the embargo of Germany was extremely important to the outcome of the war. There's no doubt about that. But the point I want to make is that the way of imagining future wars and the way of actually thinking about what made warfare particularly American was formed in World War I and formed around the idea of strategic bombing. Hmm. And I don't think that history has been absorbed. I don't think the implications of it have been absorbed.
Let's talk with some other people who are listening. The next is in Champaign and on line one. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. In regard to that thesis, I wonder if you have an opinion on the recent book by Dominic Jenkins, The Final Frontier, America, Science, and Terror. He begins with an amazing account of a simulated bombing of New York in 1921 by Billy Mitchell and friends. And the newspaper accounts that he quotes, you know, could have been about 9/11. Just an amazing shock start for the book. And goes on to discuss Billy Mitchell's articles in 1932 saying the way we're going to attack the Japanese is burn out the center of their cities. Their mm-hmm. cities are all made of wood, so we need big bombs to burn up the center of Japanese cities. Amazing story.
It's such a pleasure to learn about a book that I absolutely must read. Well, I have not read this, but I absolutely will be reading it very soon.
It's brand new, and it's come to me just because the teacher of the author is a friend who sent it to me. It was published, I don't even know whether it's been published in the U.S. Verso publishes it in Britain, and the date on it is 2002, but as I say, I got it in the mail.
You just received
personal
it.
Connection.
Well, I can't comment on that to a certain extent. Certainly Mitchell, in his views about democratizing warfare, and what a horrible phrase that is,
mm-hmm.
Set a tone for how we would conduct our wars. And certainly it is the way we fought the war openly in Japan, and I would say covertly during World War II in Europe. That is, the American public was really not allowed to know that we were doing anything other than bombing strategic sites in Europe, that we were not engaging in firebombing of cities, that we were not trying to terrorize the civilian population. It just was regarded as something that we weren't supposed to know.
Well, I think you're absolutely right, and I think your point earlier about the growth of the military-industrial complex from the First World War
mm-hmm.
Is one half of the argument that Jenkins is putting forward here, the other being this point about the connection with terror, that terror was essentially the nature, or democratizing warfare, if you prefer, the nature of aerial bombing. And the conjunction of the two began not with the Second World War, but, as you've been pointing out, with the First.
Yeah, isn't it fascinating to think that we begin by vilifying the Germans for the use of Zeppelins? And believe me, the Germans are very proud of it. They made postcards of Zeppelins bombing Antwerp.
Mm-hmm.
And these were things that they were celebrating about themselves. But by the end of the war, you know, it's just seen as, yeah, this is the way to do it. Why are we killing off all of our young men when we could be terrorizing the civilian population into revolting against their governments to put a stop to war?
That's particularly interesting now that we're only beginning to hear, only in the last year and so,
mm-hmm.
Detailed accounts of the effect of Allied bombing of Germany during the Second World War. W.G. Siebold's book last year, and these accounts of what the latter stages of the war in Europe, the war against Germany, was really like in the cities. That's only now is that coming to.
You're absolutely right. That's a retrieved history, and
yes.
Actually, the accounts of the firebombing of Tokyo have never impressed
yes.
the American imagination the way Hiroshima and Nagasaki did. But more people were killed in the firebombing
exactly.
of Tokyo. And in fact, more people were killed in the firebombing of Tokyo than in any other military battle in the history of the world. And if you read LeMay's account of that, it is absolutely blood-chilling. He ordered that firebombing, and they created a grid, and the planes flew a grid, dropped incendiary bombs. And he said because they had dispersed their manufacturer, and there were various drill presses in houses all around Tokyo that you couldn't just bomb a factory. You had to roast them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the language he uses in his book in the 60s to defend what they had done in World War II as far as, you know, it's just terror bombing. That's what it is. It's to destroy the population.
And it hasn't gone away. I mean, May, after all, was the man who directed the air war against Vietnam, where we dropped 2.5 times the ordnance used in Europe in World War II on a peasant country in Southeast Asia.
And, of course, he wrote that book to defend himself against the criticism in Vietnam. And I guess one of the things that I really do want to ask is how we've come to accept, in our imagination as Americans, bombing cities now. In other words, during the Persian Gulf War, no pictures of B-52s were allowed to be shown. They couldn't, photographers couldn't come on the bases. Nobody was allowed to get near those planes. But boy, we saw a lot of stealth bombers taking off and landing, taking off and landing. So we can glorify this sort of image of the fighter pilot taking off at dawn, even though somewhere in the back of our mind we know he's going to go bomb a city. But boy, we sure can't take that image of those big B-52s going to bomb a city, although they did the bulk of the bomb dropping in the Persian Gulf War.
Well, I'm glad you're talking about these topics. Thanks very much.
Yeah, thanks for mentioning the book.
We have about 10 minutes left, and again, I should introduce our guest, Linda Robertson. She's a scholar of the media. She's particularly interested in war propaganda and how that has shaped the American imagination. She's professor of writing and rhetoric at Hobart and William Smith Colleges in Geneva, New York. She's also the founder and director of the Media and Society Program there, and is author of the book, The Dream of Civilized Warfare, World War I Flying Aces and the American Imagination. University of Minnesota Press is the publisher, which takes a look at how the image of the World War I Flying Ace was crafted, about the development and growth of the American Air Force, and the idea of American air power and war waged from the air. A lot of those things we associate with World War II, but in the book she makes the argument, and has had to make the argument here, that a lot of these ideas really do, in fact, go back before World War II. They go back to World War I. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. We have someone next in Champaign County, and this would be line number two. Hello.
Yeah, I'm sure the previous caller will email you the review that he did of that book that he was just talking about. So he has shared it with some people around town. As an aside, I wanted to mention that the Senate's taking testimony to the confirmation of a new head of the Selective Service. So maybe they should filibuster that. That's a digression, but it's just. I wanted to ask about. One thing I want to ask about is the reaction you're getting in maybe military historian circles and journals. But something sticks in my mind is that there was a revulsion of the bombing in Guernica when the Germans were aiding the mm-hmm. Spanish Civil War. But and some people point to that as the first mass-scale bombing. But didn't the U.S. use aerial bombardment in Nicaragua in the 30s?
Well, let's see. You have a couple of questions going on. I think the bombing of Guernica. Was that it was a city where there was no reason to bomb it. Okay, and I also think it's because it was part of a particular war, that it just struck the European imagination so powerfully. I think because Europeans could probably see what was coming, because they'd been through World War I. As far as American bombing in Nicaragua, you know, I'm not as familiar with that as probably you are. But my guess is it may not have been as extensive as it was in the in Spain. Why don't you tell me a little bit more about that?
I don't know. Is the caller still there?
Yeah. Well, I don't actually know how extensive it was, too, but I understand it was. And it seems to me that it's a chapter that's... It wasn't Europeans that were being bombed. It was like the use of chemical weapons by the British under Churchill in now present-day Iraq that was used. It's just not something that's talked about much, and I think it's partially racism. I actually don't know the exact details of how extensive it was, but it was done. And One thing that gets to your major thesis that I'll return to is the chapter, I'm sure you read H.G. Wells' section in the Outline of History where he talks about how aerial power was going to end war.
So, yes.
That's related to your topic, I guess.
Yeah, I think that the, in fact, the whole notion of mechanized warfare has been a consistent argument that it will end warfare, only it doesn't, so they go to the next level. In other words, as warfare became increasingly mechanized during our own civil war, there was the notion that, oh, well, this will really shorten wars. Because who's going to want to fight a war in this way? It will lead to the quick capitulation of the enemy. So that the notion of Ironsides, you know, going up against boats that were made from wood. During the Civil War, the argument was, well, you know, once warfare is fought with crank and shaft, once it becomes more efficient, more industrialized, it will quickly end wars because nobody's going to want to fight them. Same thing was said about the machine gun. Same thing was said about the submarine. And so then the next thing was it was said about bombing from the skies, that this will create wars that either don't happen because it's a deterrent or they'll end so quickly because the civilian population will be outraged. And as you know, the exact same arguments then came to be used for nuclear weapons. It was a justification for mutual assured destruction during the Cold War. So the idea that the more horrifying the weapon, the more distance the soldier is from looking his opponent in the eye and actually having to shoot him, the more you don't have to see your enemy and the more of your enemy you can destroy without looking at him, the more quickly the wars will be over, has been with us for a long time. And, you know, there's some people argue that it was true of the nuclear standoff. I think I accept the argument that nuclear weapons aren't really weapons at all, because they assure the destruction of the human race.
But they're used by intimidation.
Yes.
More than they're used actually.
Which is why they're called by some people not really military weapons at all. That there's something quite different about saying, you know, if you're not intimidated by this, I'll destroy you and me both.
What about the idea of the reaction to your ideas in the military?
Yeah, it hasn't been out long enough to get a lot of formal reviews, but I have heard from military people who like most of the book, excepting the last chapter, where I review how I think the major ideas laid down in World War I have played out through to our current involvement in air war in Iraq. And without telling me why, and again, these are informal, they're not formal reviews, I have had some correspondence where people, for instance, teaching at the War College say that they don't agree. Now, my impression from other reviews that I had of this book while it was in production is that for people who are very deeply involved in military history and as opposed to the social history of war, anytime you bring up the cultural factors, how it affects society as large, issues of social morality, that's not military history. And so there's a sense of it not being within their range of acceptability. So I do want to make the distinction that this is not military history. This is social history of warfare. And it's a very, I think, different way of looking at warfare, and there are fewer of us working in that field. There are some wonderful people who really shape my thinking a lot, one of whom is Michael Adams, whose work on the social history of both World War I and World War II is absolutely brilliant. And I would say my work has also been very much shaped by Fussell's work on World War I and how it affected the imagination in the period that followed. So, you know, military people and military historians may find ways to object to this book. I'm looking at it as a social history of warfare.
We have some other callers here. Let's go. Okay. We have somebody on cell phone on line 4. Let's go there. Hello.
Yes. I have a question about the aspect of leaving out the casualties of war that seems to be either with air war or war in general in their modern era, thinking specifically of Vietnam and North Korea. Noam Chomsky mentions the fact that when he asked people how many people died of Vietnamese, the 100,000 figure comes up, and the actual figure, its official figure, seems to be around 2 million.
Mm-hmm.
Some people figure that it's much beyond that, and the Korean War was 2 million. Is there a particular reason that these figures have been left from people's perceptions so dramatically? And I'll let go. And I guess one of the reasons why I ask is because I think sometimes with the coverage of the Gulf War and the recently the Iraqi War, you will see that very little blood, very high-tech weapons, and there seems to be a similarity between the propaganda film that was done on Poland with the Germans, and how we put such a clean face on our war today. And I'll hang up and let you comment on that.
I do think that the question of ground casualties is really extremely important to understanding how Americans maintain this sense that air war is somehow a cleaner and more moral war, way of fighting war. According to the Geneva Conventions, combatants really are required to give as honest a tally as they can of the both the combatants and also the non-combatants who are killed. We have elected to do that, not to do that, and we've received very little criticism for it, which I think is a very big issue because it allows Americans to think a certain way about how we conduct war. The problem with World War One is that equal combatants engaged in it, and it's really a senseless way. From a military point of view, you don't go up against an equal. You sign a treaty with that party. So the wars that we have fought since have tended to either involve us in a morass where we don't want to mention how many casualties either we're taking or the opponents are taking, but particularly with regard to our conduct in Afghanistan, I would say Bosnia-Herzegovina, and certainly in Belgrade. And certainly in both of our actions in the Persian Gulf, we've been extremely hesitant to mention both how many combatants we have killed and certainly how many civilians have died. I showed a documentary last semester to my students that took us into the families of some young people, college-age students in Baghdad. And one of those students took us on video to visit his aunt, who had lost a son as a result of cluster bombing in their neighborhood. And the woman was, of course, deeply bereaved, and she was saying, you know, this is illegal. This is illegal. Now, my students, had no understanding of what she was talking about. They thought, they were very moved by the fact that, you know, civilians and children were being killed by our bombing. But they had no realization of what it means for somebody to say, you're not supposed to drop cluster bombs in neighborhoods. Because our images that were very precise. We go after non-human targets unless it's Saddam Hussein. I think that there has been a diversion of the imagination from this. I know there has been from comparing the clips of the same incidents in the war as covered by Arab networks compared to how CNN was covering it, where the Arab networks really would look at the fact that people had been killed in our actions. And why is that? I think it's because Americans do have a very strong sense of the morality of warfare, that we really do believe we should be fighting this in what we would call a civilized manner, and that people in power recognize that basic morality. So my concern is to find ways for Americans to not be allowed to avert their eyes, because Americans do have the correct feeling about war once it's brought to their attention. I think too often we give ourselves permission not to know. And I think that's reinforced by the failure to report what we ought to know about the consequences of our actions.
We are going to have to leave it at that because we've come to the end of the time. If you're interested, however, in reading more on the subject, you definitely should look at the book we have talked about here by our guest Linda Robertson. It's titled The Dream of Civilized Warfare, published by the University of Minnesota Press. She's a scholar of the media. She's professor of writing and rhetoric at Hobart and William Smith Colleges in Geneva, New York. She's the founder and director of the Media and Society Program at the colleges. Also, we want to say thanks to the folks there at WEOS Radio for setting up the connection. And Professor Robertson, thank you very much for talking
to us. It was a great pleasure. Thank you very much.